Uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. Pardon me. On May 24th, several news outlets reported on the internal workings of a Chinese-run Uyghur internment camp in the western part of the country. The reports included detailed blueprints of the camp's interiors, classified speeches from officials, and the personal information of police officers. Anonymous source hacked the information, got it out of China and into the hands of journalists. It's part of a recent trend in resurgent hacktivism. With me today to talk about all of this is Motherboard staff writer Joseph Cox. JC, as always, it's a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so for anyone who doesn't know, kind of some basic stuff up here at the top. Can you tell me about how China treats its Turkic and Uyghur minorities and kind of what they face?
Yeah, sure. I mean, for years, the Chinese state has been waging what is, you know, essentially a cultural genocide on these ethnic groups. It all started way back where there was a relatively small terrorist attack committed by somebody of Uyghur descent. Ever since then, the Chinese state has responded, you know, in by physically detaining people in these so-called re-education camps, and also creating a massive apparatus of surveillance, and that includes everything from planting malware onto Uyghurs' phones, and we also found on tourists entering that part of the country, right up to facial recognition systems being deployed and people being tracked that way. I mean, it is sort of a worst case scenario, the nightmare scenario for what digital surveillance can look like if turned towards a particular population.
Right. It's kind of, I hate to use the word fascinating because it's so awful, but it is to watch what China has done and built there. Just like you said, it's everything we're afraid of, I think, at Motherboard, right? It's all of the stuff that we kind of warn against when we talk about things like the Citizen app and ShotCaller and all of these different kinds of things. Like, these are the places, this is the darkest, one of the darkest places it can go, right? Is a large group of people being surveilled, almost cities built around them, you know, physically and digitally, and all of their movements tracked.
Yeah, I mean, this is what happens when you have a truly authoritarian state married with technical capability, let's say, right? You know, obviously, China has a massive capability and industry able to produce surveillance software and technologies. And of course, you know, this cultural genocide of the Uyghur population comes from the very highest political levels of the government. So when you marry that authoritarian leaning with the technology, this is what happens, you know.
All right, so what is in these documents?
Sure, so I'm looking at the main website for the Xinjiang Police Files Now, which was put together by the organization that originally received the files, called Victims of Communist Memorial, Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. And the documents themselves, well, it's more of a very wide selection of files. So you'll have very visual stuff, which is images of police operations, you know, training, that sort of thing, showing just how brutal the police forces want to be. You then have key documents, which are stuff like speeches and policy directives, which show that this approach, you know, as we all know, but it's good to see it in documentation, obviously, this isn't just a few bad apples or something. This is a truly gargantuan officially rolled out policy, and the speeches and the directives can give some indication of that. And then I think probably most viscerally, there are also images of detainees, you know, something like over 2,800 images of people who are detained in these concentration camps, essentially. And you can just scroll through them and see who these people are. You know, journalists have taken this information that was shared with them by the organization. You know, some have made visualizations, making it easy to go through the data, all of that sort of thing. But it's a really rich and deep data set that we've got here. You know, there have been other leaks out of Xinjiang before. You know, as I mentioned, we reported about the piece of malware installed on tourists' phones. And obviously, although what tourists may be exposed to is absolutely nothing compared to what the local population is exposed to, that still gave an indication of the, you know, the lengths to which the Chinese state was going with this. And that was all fine and good, and we got some impact with that, with antivirus companies adding that piece of malware to their antivirus search engines. But it's not really, it's not much to look at. You know, when you upload an APK to GitHub or whatever, it's readers don't necessarily react to that, let's say, emotionally, right? This is different. This is a lot more real, I think, for a lot more people.
And I have to shout out, I think the BBC in particular, who I think has had the information for a little while, because it is such a huge... You know, you and I have both worked on these kinds of projects before where you just have a giant dump of information, and it's up to you as the journalist to kind of sort it out and make it, present it in a palatable way that makes sense. So when you have like all of these pictures and all of these, you know, speeches and all of the stuff that is about these inner workings of these camps, it can be very hard to even know where to start presenting it. And it was quite taken with what the BBC did, where they kind of put together like a graphics package almost, where you, as you scroll through the story, it shows you, all right, this is a camp. This is where the guards are. This is what it look. This is what, you know, daily life in one of these camps kinds of looks like. And that interspersed with, you know, pictures of people that have been detained there. Right. And, you know, actual pictures of the documents that have been scanned, that kind of thing. I thought that was affecting.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there aren't really any new, let's say, facts in this data dump, right? We know that the Chinese state is doing this. We know that they are carrying out this cultural genocide. We know that they are running these massive concentration or internment camps. All of that is very well known and has been covered by, you know, a lot of very good journalists and whistleblowers around the world. This just gives you a much more tangible sense of how real it is. And the fact of the matter is that often when journalism is trying to generate impact, or maybe not even trying, but journalism generates more impact when people really understand the issue that is going on. And maybe this sort of visual aid from this material can help people better understand what exactly is actually happening in these camps. That doesn't mean anything's going to necessarily stop, unfortunately. You know, of course, this is a monumental, colossal issue, but people are going to come away from this hack understanding more of what's actually going on, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important to note that the Chinese Communist Party, it's not as if they deny that these camps exist or what is taking place in there. I think that what their disagreement is in degree and the way that it is portrayed other places, right? Because these are things that, like, they themselves take pictures of, show video of, and show people internally, right? Like, probably not the worst abuses, not the worst of what we see, but it's not... These things are not secret, right?
Right. I mean, the Chinese state frames them as something like reintegration camps, something like that. You know, oh, we have this minority population and we're trying to help them. You know, well, they'll be closer to, you know, the main Chinese population. They'll understand it better. They'll be able to work after that. They present it more as an opportunity for helping these people, when in reality it is trying to aggressively assimilate that population with the majority to basically wipe out any cultural heritage that the Uyghurs or ever ethnic minority groups may actually have in that country, despite them, you know, this being their home, obviously.
Right. All right. So what do we know about where these documents came from and how they were acquired?
We don't know much on the specifics, but what was very interesting is that the organization that first obtained the documents and then, you know, multiple instances of the journalistic articles based upon those did explicitly say that this was obtained through hacking, you know, and we've had big leaks before that have been suspected of being a hack. You know, I think some of the financial disclosures from, you know, big offshore banking firms, some of those were suspected of being via hackers, but it was never really said either way. In this one, it explicitly says the source independently got these through hacking, right? And I'll just bring up the quote that, Dr. Adrian Zenz, who is the director and senior fellow in China studies at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, which originally obtained the documents, he told me when the information came out, this is the first hack that he knows of when it comes to information coming out of Xinjiang. Now, we've definitely seen data leaks come out from the area or related to the area. The Intercept did a January 2021 story about a massive police database, but it didn't say whether that was hacked or exposed or something like that. I think we've actually obtained data sets related to Xinjiang previously as well, but they were exposed sort of servers online, you know, where someone misconfigures it and there's no password or something, and then it gets scanned by a researcher, they download it, that sort of thing. I think there's actually been a few of those, and even more generally when it comes to the Chinese state apparatus. But according to Zenz, this is the first hack that they know of. And the BBC, as I mentioned, they were very explicit, and what they said was that the anonymous source had claimed to, quote, have hacked, downloaded, and decrypted the files from a number of police computer servers in the Xinjiang region. So, I mean, that's about as much as we know about where it came from, but it is interesting that they're being very explicit about, look, this came from hacking. And I think maybe a few years ago, maybe journalistic outlets would have been a lot more nervous to admit that. You know, maybe the lawyers would have got involved, maybe they would have been a little bit scared about admitting that. I think nowadays media outlets much better understand the value that hacked data can present, even if it was obtained via something that would be a crime in certain countries, right? But there is obviously a public interest in this material, and I think journalists and academics increasingly see that and are increasingly okay with saying where the data came from. And if anything, I think it's a benefit as well. Like, this is not, oh, some shadowy person leaked us some documents necessarily that people could say were fake or whatever. It's like, we verified that these documents are real. That's what the journalists did. And we know that they came from within inside Chinese computer servers themselves. You know, if anything, that's beneficial to make people pay attention.
Do you think then there's a benefit if you are a hacktivist and you want to get this information out to coming forward and saying, like, yes, we acquired this through hacking. We pulled it out.
I think so, in some ways, because it can prove or at least give a little bit more legitimacy to the authenticity of the documents, right? And that doesn't mean that people don't fake documents. That can happen as well. But I think the combination of saying it came from hacking and it going through journalistic outlets, that is how you really generate a buzz about this material. I mean, let's say in another universe, this went a little bit differently, and the hacker got all of this data, and they uploaded it on Mega or some other sort of distribution service, and they just like leaked it on Twitter or something. First of all, that probably would have got removed from Twitter based on their new hacking material policies. They probably would have removed any tweets, you know, they included that information. But I think the impacts, or at least the attention, probably would have been a bit a lot lower, right? There would have been a few articles saying, oh my God, like Xinjiang police were hacked. And we probably would have done those as well, because of course that is still newsworthy. But not necessarily that many people would go through the documents, because there would be the added pressure of, well, we don't know if we're going to be able to actually do this because maybe a competitor is doing it. And maybe we just have to move on to other things. This way of the hacker, whoever they are, being a lot more tactical by going to somebody, this organization that clearly cares about Xinjiang and are experts in the cultural genocide going on there, who could then verify the documents, go through them in great detail without feeling the time pressure of, well, this stuff's just on the internet now. It allowed them to do this properly, you know, and I think that it's demonstrated just by the depth and the wealth and the richness of the coverage. I don't think you would have coverage this good and this visceral and potentially this informative if the hacker had just posted a link online, you know?
I have to say, you just admirably set up the back half of this podcast and everything I want to talk about. but first, we're going to pause here for a break. You are listening to Cyber. I am Matthew Galt talking to Joseph Cox about hacktivism, and we will be right back after a few words from our sponsor.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right, cyber listeners, thank you for sticking with us. We are on talking with Joseph Cox about some files that were hacked out of police servers in Western China. So there's a lot I want to talk about with all the things that you just brought up, but I want to focus on Twitter first. You mentioned that their hacking policy. Can you just explain what that is to the audience and like how things get tagged when they're shared online or even taken down?
Sure. So, I mean, for years, Twitter has actually been a pretty useful distribution tool for all sorts of hackers. Now, that might be hacktivists who have got something that they believe is in the public interest and they're leaking that online. They post a link to it, other people share it, people take screenshots, that sort of thing. It can also be beneficial to more financially motivated hackers who may be tweeting information to try to extort a victim, let's say. So there's a very wide spectrum of the sort of distribution of hacking material that has happened on Twitter for a very, very long time. Somewhat recently, you know, in the past couple of years, Twitter actually changed its policy where you're not allowed to tweet links to hacked material, and you're not allowed to post those screenshots to that hacked material. That is obviously a very broad policy in some ways, and I guess you kind of have to take it case by case, but some examples is that the transparency organization distributed to Dial of Secrets, which often uploads plenty of these sorts of data breaches, they were suspended from Twitter. You can't post a link to distributed Denial of Secrets website on Twitter in a tweet anymore, I don't think. I think that's still the case. And I believe around the time of the Blue Leaks leak, which was of US police databases that distributed Denial of Secrets was banned from Twitter over, I think if you were just a Twitter user posting screenshots from that as well, you'd have the tweets removed or something like that. So this policy, I don't think it came out of nowhere, obviously. I think it started when post-2016, you know, Guccifer 2.0 using Twitter to distribute information that was hacked from the DNC and that sort of thing. And then you have the Blue Leaks data breach as well. And Twitter has just clamped down on it. And I think more recently as well, you also had the Hunter Biden laptop story, right? Where information sourced from Hunter Biden's laptop was put in some online news articles, including from the New York Post, and Twitter bottlenecked distribution of those articles. That was a little bit different in that it wasn't necessarily sourced through hacking itself, but it's sort of related in that Twitter has clamped down on the distribution of certain pieces of, you know, sketchily sourced information, let's say.
Okay, so someone at Twitter is making decision about, like, what is good hacking and what's bad hacking then, right, is what it sounds like, because this is getting shared, right? This is information that was acquired through hacking, right? Like, I can still share the BBC article, I can share the Vice article, et cetera, et cetera. Do we have any indication of, like, what the difference is in their minds?
No, that's really, really hard to say. And I think it would probably come down to some sort of public interest argument or some sort of amplification of harm argument, you know? So the Hunter Biden one taken down because they believe there may have been state involvement, you know, in the source of Russian state involvement in the sourcing of that information. When it came to the Blue Leak stuff and they stopped distribution of that, I mean, I think there's a massive public interest in some of the information in there. So it's really hard to say what counts as a good hack and what doesn't, basically. I think nowadays Twitter, generally speaking, is going to err onto the side of if it's hacking, we're probably going to ban it. The difference sort of with the Xinjiang police files is that it's not a Twitter account, which is, you know, at Xinjiang police files, we've hacked it and we're dumping the information. It is articles coming from the BBC. Yeah, exactly. So it's hard to say, but ultimately Twitter does have to make and does make decisions around what to distribute on its platform.
Well, I would also say, and this is maybe the cynical realpolitik Matthew talking, Twitter not doing a lot of business in China either, right?
Right. Yes. They don't really have a market there. So maybe that's the reason as well. And maybe they just see the public interest in this sort of material as well. It's hard to say, but they do draw a line somewhere. Right. And it's their line. Again, I would have allowed the distribution of the Blue Leak stuff, depending on the individual files. But yeah, they are making decisions about that.
What, in your mind, what distinguishes a hacktivist from a regular hacker?
It's hard to say because they're also making a decision on what they think is in the public interest, right? But generally speaking, a hacktivist is someone who goes out and they will break into a company. Maybe they'll wipe the information. Maybe they'll steal the information because they believe there is a benefit in doing so, not for financial gain, but generally speaking, so people could be more informed. So, you know, several years ago, me and our colleague Lorenzo, we did a series of stories all about the consumer spyware industry or the stalkerware industry, where ordinary people install smartphone malware onto the phones of their significant others in abusive relationships, right? That series was based on not one, but two data breaches at two separate stalkerware companies. And from what I remember, the hackers who went into those companies did it very much so because they thought this industry is fucked up and we want to impact it somehow, you know? And they exfiltrated the data. They gave it to us. We verified it. We produced a slew of articles on it, and there was some impact from that. You know, I think eventually the FTC banned one of the companies and its CEO from ever making stalkerware ever again, stuff like that. I would say that is a pretty clear case of hacktivism. You know, they saw it as a public interest. Yes, it involved a crime. Yes, it involved breaking into people's computers, but they believe there was a public interest argument there. Now, it can get a little bit blurry where people will start claiming hacktivism when it's actually something else. You know, it could be a state agency, Russia or whoever, claiming they're anonymous when actually it's, you know, the GRU sat in Moscow in their facility. Or it could be a financially motivated hacker who claims they're trying to expose information in the public interest, but actually they're just trying to extort extort a victim. So it lots of people will operate underneath that banner, but it's very case by case on who could be called, you know, legitimately be called a hacktivist.
I also want to get into how the information is handled once it's acquired, because I think that's pretty interesting. And I think we can use two historical examples to talk about this. I think when people think of hacktivism, they often think of like WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden, and Julian Assange. So Snowden and Assange had two very different methods for getting the information out. One, just pretty much info dump, right? Just put everything online. Snowden actually sought out, you know, Glenn Greenwald and Laura, I can't never say her last name, Porteous. Who made the documentary, tried to get journalists to help him kind of sort what he had to get the information out. This recent hack also, they, you know, got an international coalition of journalists together. It's not just the BBC that has the story. Lots of people have the story to report on this. What do you think it's important that which method, I guess, do you think is more effective? I mean, I know what your answer is going to be, but for the sake of the conversation, which one of these methods do you think gets the information out in a better way?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, very generally speaking, I would say that I do think there is a benefit where hackers obtain information, you know, using their skills, and then of their own volition and their decision, they might decide to provide it to journalists, you know. And again, I'm never going to tell a source, hey, dump it or don't dump it or definitely give it to me or something. It is entirely the source's decision. But I would just point to sort of the increasingly long history of hackers providing information to journalists, in that it can be very effective, mostly for giving the data legitimacy. You know, you give it to journalists, they go out, they verify it, they maybe do additional reporting, they make sure everything is authentic, and they put it in context for an ordinary reader. A hacker may be incredible at sourcing information. They may not have all the context for communicating that to a reader. You know, that's the journalist's part of the job, whereas, you know, the journalist obviously can't go and source this information themselves as well. I think there can be a partnership there. I mean, I think I actually gave a talk on this several years ago now, called Hackers Journalists Unite at some sort of hackers conference, where I was like, we should work together, but without implicating each other in crimes. Obviously, there was a whole legal section on that. But basically, the point of that was that we can benefit each other while acknowledging that, yes, we may have different motivations. We have different ways of operating as well. But the public interest can be served by the collaboration of those efforts. And I guess I would just caveat it with saying, like, we're not working together side by side. The hacker hands over the information and then the journalist does their thing. It is not necessarily a collaborative relationship. Well, certainly not. You're not going to ask the hacker to go, hey, can you go get this information out of their computer systems? No, you don't do that. You take whatever, or you offer to take whatever the hacker has exfiltrated. You don't become a party to the hack. You know, that is the issue that Julian Assange did when he offered to, you know, crack a password hash for Chelsea Manning. And that's how you end up in hot water, obviously. But yeah, I think public interest can be served by those two groups working together.
Speaking of Assange, I also think that there's a danger when the hacker does not remain anonymous. Is then we're such a personality-driven culture that it's very easy for the stories to become about Assange or Snowden and not what they uncovered. And I've noticed that in the last, you know, 15 years of this kind of stuff playing out, the personalities have been a lot more anonymous. Do you think that's true? And do you think that that's a good thing?
I think it could be a mixed bag, because the reason that Snowden originally announced himself as the leaker was that so the narrative could not be hijacked, right? So they could not say, oh, this was a hostile Chinese or Russian operation. He wanted to own it, to say, no, look, I'm a whistleblower. There's a public interest in this information. I'm coming forward. And I think for the sake of the story and the issue of massive government, US government surveillance, that was the right call. But as you allude to, he's now become a personality sort of in his own right, a story in his own right. And I think maybe just with Snowden, it's just because so much time has passed. You know, we're coming up to 10 years after the Snowden revelations. They happened in 2013, right? You know, next year will be the anniversary. Maybe it's just been a very long time, you know, and that's why he's come up again. But generally speaking, I think that anonymity can be beneficial in that you're not looking at the personality, you are looking at the data, at the story. You know, and maybe a recent example could be something like the Pegasus Papers, where various outlets from around the world, they reported on the basically a sort of de facto target list of clients of the government malware vendor NSO Group. Included all these French politicians and various other people. Amnesty International obtained that information and gave it to journalists, that sort of thing. There was no sort of character for people to latch onto. You know what I mean? It was purely about the papers and the data itself. So I think it can go, either way. But if you don't, if there isn't a danger of the narrative being hijacked, maybe it is better just to stay anonymous. Yeah.
What are some of the other recent incidents of hacktivism?
The Blue Leaks one, as I mentioned, was probably one of the most significant ones, which is where a hacker who said they operated under the umbrella of Anonymous broke into a fusion center, which are sort of these intelligence hubs that federal and local and state police in the United States use. And they got a whole bevy of information about how US police operate. You know, that was probably the first major one in quite a long time. Ever since then, there's been, you know, several smaller ones, and distributed denial of secrets has been probably the main distributor of a lot of those. But sort of the next chapter, probably in hacktivism recently, has been the Ukraine conflict, right? Or Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We've had a dizzying amount of hacktivism in support of Ukraine, targeting Russian businesses, entities, government agencies, that sort of thing. I've never seen that amount of activity from so many different parties at once targeting one general organization, you know, that being the Russian government or its offshoots, right? That was and still is a whole other level of hacktivism. And I think that's where we are now, where we're in this post-anonymous, when it was a very, very long time ago and they were breaking into companies and they went down for a bit. Then Blue Leaks happens, it sort of comes back. Also the breaches of Hacking Team and FinFisher by Phineas Fisher that we covered a lot as well. So it has been ebbing and flowing. And now I think we're pretty solidly back in sort of a second, maybe a third age. I'd probably say a second age of hacktivism, for sure.
All right, let's say I want to know a little bit about how the sausage is made, or I want the audience to know a little bit of how the sausage is made here. Let's say you get approached a couple hours from now, you get a message. Somebody says they have something for you. How do you go about beginning to work with an anonymous hacker and vet their information?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, this will often happen over an encrypted chat channel, you know, Wickr or Jabber, not so much now because Jabber is just overrun by spam, so it's unusable, but it'll be, you know, some sort of encrypted chat program that I have, and we make those publicly available so people can just reach out, you know. They will maybe say they have a story, and I'll say, okay, what's it about? Often they will just send the data, and other times they won't, and you may have to ask them, hey, that's a very big claim that you say you've hacked this company. Can I look at the data? And I wouldn't say it's a negotiation, because that's sort of the wrong connotation, but there's a back and forth, a conversation where I'm basically trying to establish, first of all, how legit this feels, and you develop a feel for whether it feels real or not. Obviously, who the target is and what the data involves. And then ultimately being able to obtain that data so we can authenticate it. You know, in the worst case scenario, you won't get the data and you'll have to try and verify a company's been hacked another way. And that can work by I'll approach the company with some information and they'll confirm the breach, or I'll talk to some employees or whatever. But really you want the data set, because we have, once we have that, we have various ways of authenticating it. And I mean, one of the most popular ones or most successful ones that we do is, let's say it is a database of usernames and passwords or something like that. We won't go and just log into people's accounts, because you can't do that. We will go to the website and we will, let me make a new account and I'll try to make an account with some of the usernames, including the spreadsheet. And if it's legit, the website may say, you can't do that. This user already exists. So that is indicating that my spreadsheet does relate to data that is on the back end. And then that's a pretty good point where you know where you can probably move forward with the story. But beyond the technical verification, a lot of it is dealing with those sometimes conflicting motivations, right? You know, I would actually say the majority of hackers I speak to are not hacktivists. So I'd probably say about 30% are hacktivists. 70% are financially motivated criminal hackers, just because that's sort of the niche that I've kind of carved out for myself, right? And you have to constantly talk to them, knowing that they are likely a criminal, and to not incriminate yourself. You know, I don't offer to help. When I recently had one hacker say, hey, can you contact Electronic Arts and deliver our ransom message? I'm like, no, obviously not. You have to remain independent while interested, while verifying. And it's a very tricky balance. But I think I would just end this point by just saying that hackers, probably more often than not, do respect it when you draw a line saying, I'm not here to help you, but I think there's public interest in this information. And if you share it, I will do my absolute best to report on the public interest that this data contains, basically.
Yeah, I think that that's like a misconception that people have about journalists and how we work. Very often when we are dealing with a source or talking to somebody, we're pretty brutally honest. At least I try to be, about like what our motivations are and how this process is going to work. It's because we don't want them to be taken by surprise when we, you know, won't deliver a ransom note to EA for them. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I think that transparency is helpful for everyone. You mm-hmm. know, it gives the source a better understanding of journalistically what is going on here. Obviously puts us in a better position because we have to remain impartial. You know, we have to remain independent. So just that sort of red line of drawing a line in the sand, it benefits everybody. And ultimately, it benefits the readers, because if we publish an article and it turns out we're not impartial, it undermines the story, even if there was public interest in it. You know, yeah. That's why we're being independent, ultimately for the benefit of our readers and the story.
Yeah. Joseph Cox, thank you so much for walking us through this. I do have one thing I want to bring up before I let you go, because you forced me to see this right before we got on the air. You and I have both beaten Elden Ring.
Yes.
At this point.
Yes. Great game.
Great game. Wonderful game. Apparently Elon Musk also just beat Elden Ring. And he tweeted out his build.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
I am too. I've got it pulled up. He's level 111, which is respectable. Like, if you're at the end of the game, it's a level that makes sense. His equip load, though, is 67.2 out of 68.8. Elon is fat rolling through Elden Ring. It's very upsetting. And just like looking at his gear set and what he's got set up, my man's got two shields on his left hand.
Uh-huh.
Like, I feel like if you would just clear out one of those, he could at least be medium rolling, right?
Yes. I just think it's fantastic that somebody who's constantly seen as this sort of superhuman genius is having an issue with one of the most basic mechanics of this game, is that maybe you shouldn't carry a shitload of stuff at the same time, because otherwise you're going to be heavy rolling everywhere, you know? I don't know. We can't claim many victories in this very depressing time you know, and especially against Musk when he's just flat out denying all of these disgusting allegations against him. So I'm going to take a very small victory in looking at his Elden Ring build and being like, that is absolute trash. What the fuck are you doing?
We can absolutely judge him for his poor Elden Ring build. And his Lucet Glintstone staff's only +8? Come on, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Where are you spending those stones? What's going on?
It is ridiculous. And I tweeted about it and someone replied to it that the idea of Elon heavy rolling everywhere throughout the game brings him joy. I was like, I'm going to latch onto that. Just the idea that he's played this game for so long unnecessarily like that. I mean, that's pretty funny.
Yeah. All right, JC, thank you so much for coming onto Cyber and walking us through this. If you like the show, please rate us, drop a comment. Rate us on iTunes. It does help other people find the show. And we will be back a little bit later this week with another conversation about our beautiful and horrible technological world. And I think we're going to do this one on Twitch. We're going to do a live one, I think, tomorrow. And we will see you then. Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.